all the poems that I want to venture to read now are taken from a book called Signs of the Times. You shouldn't ask me precisely what the significance of the title is, because I'm not sure I could tell you. The advantage, I suppose, in titling a book of poems is that so long as the title works with the poems in the book toward achieving the effect you want to achieve, it needn't have the schematic or mathematical relationship with the contents that would be required in a scientific formula. One of the curses which anybody who is interested in reading or writing seriously, semi-seriously, for fun or whatever, is the perpetual and inescapable question of, just say, what the hell is poetry? Well, to that there's only one answer, which would be, how the hell do I know? So, I think we might very well leave it at that and investigate it. Perhaps we might find a poem or two within here. Several, I think some 8 or 10 of these poems were published in an anthology called 8 American Poets in London about 1952. And this anthology had the distinction, if you want to call it that, of receiving, to the best of my knowledge, precisely 2 reviews. One was in the Times Literary Supplement, which did not take kindly to it. It said it sounded as though the contents, written by myself and 7 other poets, had been composed toward the ragged end of a very long and drunken party as part of a game to make up for the fact that we'd drown on whiskey. The other review was Mr. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who at that time was entirely unknown to me, and he seemed to like them rather well. I don't know whether one should announce publicly that Mr. Ferlinghetti likes my poems or not, but let's try it and see if anybody else can find anything for them. Now, I think one of the more attractive features of this particular book, and probably the only touches of art in it, and it's laid on a bit heavy perhaps, are some epigraphs at the beginning. One of them is my favorite, or one of my favorite quotations, taken from Christopher Marlowe, the English dramatist. The play is Dr. Faustus, and Mephistopheles, the representative of hell, the tempter who serves Dr. Faustus, who sells his soul to the devil, makes this remark in response to some sort of question by this time panicky doctor. Mephistopheles says, "Why, this is hell, or are we out of it?" And I don't know whether this sets precisely the tone one wants or not, but I like the quotation, so I put it in. The second is from Mr. Shakespeare, of whom you heard, and perhaps you could remember where this quotation occurs. "There would have been a time for such a word." The second quotation is an old French. It's taken from the French poet, thief, murderer, pimp, François Villon, who lived during the Middle Ages. And into English, it reads, you're not alone, so don't complain. And the circumstances were that Villon was, as usual, about to be hung for having done something or other which he shouldn't, and was writing a poem about it. Now, proceeding onward, we'll take a poem from a magazine called Different, which came out in 1950, with a rather heavy title of "For Marie Who Drove Too Fast," or "Consolation Is Where You Find It." You'll notice this is one of the very few poems in the entire group that actually have rhyme and meter, which is the kind of poetry most of us are accustomed to. "The change death brings us is a dreadful thing. There should be peace behind sad eyes, for then the yearning heart is fair and still as spring, though the cold flesh shall never stir again. But death is careless with his chosen task. The unhinged body mocks its sculptor's hand. For now the mouth and eyes are like a mask that may have lived, but now is lax as sand. And this was never you. It was created to traffic with the unresponsive sod. Oh, take away the dreary unknown doll. I have some memories. And you have God." And the second one, now, this was included in the English publication, is entitled escape mechanism. The original publication was in the Midland Poetry Review, also 1940. Say, you hiders, you turners away, what can you do when the bubble burst? Can you build a new one quick enough? Or does life seep in and soil the shine with colors like soggy oil? Say, do you have to cry a little when the dream breaks down? What can you do when the dream is murdered, when your heart turns cold and dies? Sort of a white night of the soul, as it were. And here's one called well, actually, the title comes from this. The name is A Sign of the Times. It was published in a magazine called Inferno, a pacifist little poetry magazine out on the West Coast, just before the entry of the United States into the Korean police action. Once, said my mother, I could make anything grow, but now things I never used to have any trouble with simply refuse to live. Not the soil. I just don't think plants are much good these days. It may be something in the air. All I know is when I plant something, it doesn't root, it merely rots. The next poem, which was published in Epos in the summer of 1951, has some fairly personal memories for me. It concerns a boy that I was in college with and whom I regarded quite highly. He graduated the year before I did, and by the time I graduated, he was dead. How, I never knew. It was from Texas. The poem goes this way. Now you're dead, for Eric, 1951. Now you're dead, what do you know? From your low vantage point, do you understand the words the sweet roots home to the stone? Have you felt the tug of the surging soil? But this is talk. Now are you less lonely, having communion with the worms? You walk this life straight, I thought, from a dream, seeking for what? One lost face or a truth you almost knew? No matter, you smile for love, we guessed, and now you drink the sod, lie still. All is not waste. Wait for the spring, and perhaps you may grow straight and strong as some green tree. The next one, which I have to confess is a rather bad imitation of Mr. E.E. Cummings, but one which I'm rather fond of, was published in Arena, a New Zealand publication, in 1953, when the casual green of a million years flows life along the mindless, eager veins of these undetermined plants, when the angry, fruitful earth turns grandly to the wasteful sun, the visceral eye of man flickers and stinging blinks at the news of nature's huge contempt. An ignorant, constructive time, ignoring as always the insect continual drone of humanity's vast, womb-deep unhappiness, delightfully, as always, produces its perpetual, silly salutation, eternal, impossible, womb-sappy spring. And here is one of my few ventures that I love, Larry. And I don't know, it seemed well to say at the time, appeared in Trails, March 1951. It's called Wind. The wind that fingers the delicate trees, whistles through the naked ribs to warm the grimly beating heart. And in the facile memory of the mind, I see the frail dream of your face, and the breeze recalls a way it never was, a way it will never be. Love must spring a deeper gulf than that from here to any star. So shield your eyes, and what will I know? Evoked by the wind, or whatever. You go with the wind, and there is nothing, oh, nothing, but sky and cloud. I think Mr. August Derleth would tend to recognize his own style in that. This appeared in a magazine called Necromanticon. It's a sort of character portrait of an elderly gentleman I knew once. He is probably dead now. He was a writer, a psychiatrist, a colonel in the army. Something of an egotist, but with it all, a very pleasant person. His name was David Henry Keller, M.D., and we begin first with a quotation from George Santayana, written in 1887 in a letter. What you call the point of view of the grave is what I would call the point of view of the easy chair. From that, the universal joke is indeed very funny. But meantime, I beg of you, let us remember that the joke of things is one at our expense. It is very funny, but it is exceedingly unpleasant. And this is how Dr. Keller seemed to me to be. People are his mind's own secret toys. He can heal frail, injured flesh, but keen fingers of his thought lance sharp into private souls. The twisted mesh of brain is wilderness he longs to scan. He meets fear, but is not afraid. In the soul's sad and sullen marrow he finds rare good. For insight he paid his birthright. Man's bright fallacy of hope. This earth he sees is earth, no more, and mankind not exalted. But still his harsh and accurate mirth is unsubdued. So great is love for humanity's brief, sometimes brave, hour, that strife cannot break him as strength endures and gives him mastery for this giddy life. This is called Gothic Inscape with Undertones by Dr. Freud, which I shan't attempt to explain. It appeared in the Occam Sample in 1949. The poem uses rhyme. It does not use a regular meter. And I tried, at the same time I was indulging myself in rhyme, to insert as much prose rhythm, as it were, as possible into the poem. And it came out something like this. What he saw was beauty far too bright, her face a cold, clear light that froze away the endless years, her chill smile a flame consuming fears. Of that behind her crystal mask he didn't ask. Instead he sought to gain dead memories guard from pain. He would banish any spring remembered in cold fire, lest it bring too much of hurt. So in his grim embrace he clasped her, he touched her face, and from her ice-like smile he knew for once the score who'd won and lost, and withdrew despairingly from humankind into the cold one-way terror of his mind. And although I doubt if either the gentleman who created her or the lady herself would recognize it, this is a version of Coleridge's Geraldine, the Lamia or Snake Woman. This is from a magazine called Fantasy Commentator. My guess would be, although I don't have it dated, that it appeared, 48 possibly. The title's very loud and raucous. You can't fire me, I quit. Look, see now, there they go on busy, useless, endless missions. And all I know, mister, is what I know. They're mad as any hatter. Laughter strained through tight teeth, a slap on any stranger's back, that's their world, which you can take or leave. Generally, we take it. And after excitable, if vegetable youth, creeps swift, fooling, friendly age, arriving 20 years early just to be on time. I have my sun bright and barren room, which pity and prudence have brought me. I'll let them march to ceaseless doom. All flesh is grass, more or less. I wandered, disaffected stray, past the tricky edge of madness, they said. Don't haggle over words, but I see where they go, less than from whence they came, and choose to listen to mind's brittle voice whispering to me. Odi non amor. The next poem, which is rather long and much more prosaic than poetic, as it were, is really a sort of private joke. I might explain just this much, that H.P. Lovecraft and Arthur Machen, both of whom are mentioned in a sort of prose stage direction with horror story writers, both are deceased. I don't know if it's worthwhile going to the other people. The name of the poem is Displaced Persons, or, which is, this is rather flip, I'm afraid, Why the Last Vampire Jumped Ship. It appeared in Fancient in the spring-summer issue of 1951, and I felt obliged to dedicate it with apologies to Mr. August Derleth. So we begin with the stage direction. In the foreground, The sad and milk-white shades of H.P. Lovecraft and Arthur Machen make a dolorous and, because of their respective accents, badly coordinated attempt at choral reading. Edgar Allan Poe, who knew what had been coming all along, sits in the background beating a bongo drum to the tick of a metronome, his pale, poetic features slightly distorted by a grin which displays no real trace of mirth. And the two gentlemen, the choral readers, the horror story writers, deceased, speak. So howl, demon, to the moon, and gamble, monster, on the shore of fading sanity, for soon a stranger's ghoul will pour out queer songs from cracked lips. We see the conclusion of your reign. This the flaming, really, truth that rips aside your elegant shroud. We lived in vain. Poor ghost of our begetting, foolish loss. Or you swapped your murky, or you swapped, we bumble that. Or you swapped your misty heaven, deserted hell, which is murky, grudge no cost to stay, cold harbor home. Now we foretell, musty soothsayers, that none of us dare stay. And the spotlight comes again to Mr. Poe and his drum. Poe, who has abandoned his bongo drum, is apparently outlining with his ascetic hands a familiar female form. Startled by the appearance of an imaginary Joseph Wood crutch, however, he hastily sketches instead a mushroom cloud. Noticing the gesture, H.P.L. and Machen mourn, respectively, the disappearance of the elder gods and that heroic satyr, Pan. They resume, managing somehow to stay together. And again, they pick up their little chant. For mind corrupted, matter flares with the madness of will corrupted man, and mutant horrors play on burnt out soil. Ancient cherished sadness can linger only till the burning dawn, damn it to hell, explodes. You, I, we, in fact, are gone. As the two old, impalpable, and helpless horror mongers vanish, Poe rises to his feet, mutters, man doth not yield himself to the angels nor unto death utterly, save only through the weakness of his feeble will, and nods pleasantly, if unsteadily, at the few spectators, including his near cousin, Mr. Alan Tate, who had also had an idea of what had been coming for some time. Instantly, without a breath's hesitation, Mr. Tate replies in the tone of an adult recalling an impossibly happy childhood. In the original unity of the first thing lies the secondary cause of all things, with the germ of their inevitable destruction. Considerably troubled by this remark, which seems strangely familiar, but tends toward the nonsensical, Poe decides that what he needs is a drink. The scholars among you, of course, will be aware that Poe's drinking has been greatly exaggerated. On this occasion, if he is lucky, he will meet a motherly, middle-aged bee girl whom he will eventually recognize, he feels convinced, as his aunt, and whose delightful young daughter, although chastely christened Virginia, has found pleasure and profit by answering to a name which has, in the past several years, thanks to the courtesy of Mr. Vladimir Nabokov, acquired a certain singularity, Lolita. The final stage direction, a very quick curtain, followed immediately by the lonesome, desperate wail of the very last werewolf, who has obviously had it right up to here. The house lights do not come on, or do they? The next poem sacrifices a little bit of its scientific accuracy, I think, in regard to the ordinary procedures of mortuary science. In order to achieve a rhyme and a picture, this appeared in a very odd magazine called Sucky Egg Mule, Recalcitrant Beast, and went in 1951. The title is Pathologist's Prophecy. Mister, consider, though you are wonderfully almost alive, that someday, you'll not mind it, living's uncertain happy jive will not din into your careless ear. It may be an hour, maybe a year, but earth will take its casual dead, now properly emptied of all you held. They will open your head, just checking, and your mouth must smile. So, into your bluest veins they will pump death. forgetting that these were the friendly, lovely lanes wherein the heart's rapture had run. At last, beneath the thorn scalp, your eyes delighted will drink April's kindest skies. The next poem is dedicated to a very old, very good friend of mine, extremely talented young man who writes what is, I think, altogether incorrectly called science fiction. Its only appearance has been in the anthology Eight American Poets, which I mentioned before. Ray Bradbury, as you probably will recognize, has not only written such movies as Moby Dick, but is also author of The Martian Chronicles, which is, I venture to say, the best science fantasy book of this, let's say the past 40 years. Except it doesn't really take place on Mars, as opposed to it takes place in Southern California, where Ray was living at that time. The title is The Pioneers. That is the title of the poem. And it's supposed to be somewhat interplanetary, too. The Earthmen have come on careless feet, frantic for the stars. This world was old 1,000 years, but now is lost to time. The agile, clumsy hands of Earth will call the living soil to shape some passing hope. The men of Earth have clean, cold eyes. They search for a truth they never knew, a song unheard, a dream they almost had. The men of Earth have clear, fine eyes, and behind them loneliness lies like a stone to chill the tensely beating heart.